Good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're very excited to have you back here this week. We've got part two of our episode on what are the real MCIs in our emergency systems, and we're going to be looking at that with our friend and guest, Dr. Neil Richmond, who joined us after Joe Holly contacted him in a recent conference, and the two of them connected and wanted to have this discussion here on the show. And I think it's an important one. So we're going to pick up with Dr. Neil Richmond here from MedStar Mobile Healthcare, and we'll have him come on in and talk to us a little bit about what we are going to be doing when it comes to getting our ongoing training in order, along with our good QA, along with how to manage all of these things from a leadership perspective that we talked about in last week's episode. So make sure you check out our first episode in this series and then come back here for part two. And let's go ahead and get on into the rest of that call with this question coming right up. I think that that's where we missed the boat is looking at each patient as an individual and not being worried about, well, what are my scene time stats? And I think you're exactly right, Neil, that we're really stuck in some systems in a rut and a paradigm that no longer is valid, if it ever was.
Right. I agree. And it drives, and look, you know, clearly our systems have to survive, right? There's a financial bottom line. I mean, I've run a system as its overall director, had all the same problems. You know, you got to keep units on the street, you got to get people in the seats, you've got to provide people with good vacation time and benefits and FMLA and all that sort of stuff. So there's a reality to keeping the system moving. I get it. But like you say, exactly what you just said is you can't spread that to 100% of the patients. You know, maybe 80% probably don't need more than 20 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever the number is on scene. But there's some people that, and again, I don't know that it's because our folks are being driven by the time thing. It may be that, but I also do think there's something that I think we're missing in training. You know, I'll just give you one, maybe it sounds like a little off-the-wall example. I had an opportunity a few years ago with Joe and my colleagues, Crawford Meacham in Philly. We went to Israel to sort of pilot a little tactical medicine course that this group was working on. So we were sort of the guinea pigs of doing the tactical medicine. So among all the stuff they did, they also took us over to the West Bank and to a special training range and gave us some opportunity to, you know, use some automatic weapons on, you know, like mannequins that were popping up just to sort of get the experience. And mind you, you know, I'm a New York City boy and the only weapon, you know, we used were like baseball bats and chains and things like that. So like doing the whole gun thing was sort of new to me, you know, but in any event, it was interesting. So they give you this really fancy, super light, I can't remember the name, semi-automatic, you know, a gun, you know, and then they have you run in and these mannequins pop up and you shoot at them. So that would be enough, right? For me, like that's enough to figure out that I'm going to hit any one of those things. But you know what they did as we were running in? They were throwing tires at us. They were throwing bricks, glass, you know, like, and I think that's what we're missing in training. So you go and you take the standard ACLS course. Here's your mega code. Now the patient's in VFib. Now you do CPR. Now you give epi. Now you give shock. Now you give epi. And we don't train for what I think are the so-called affective, sort of the emotional, psychological elements of what happens when you get on scene and everything is pretty much going to hell. And again, the family is screaming and the first responders are breathing down your back to move the patient and the dog's barking at you and the room is dark and there's boxes and the patient is very big and they're in a bed. You know, it's like that to me is the code. It's not just knowing when to push epi, which, by the way, we still have yet to figure out whether it does anything, right? Like we spend an enormous amount of time training on a bunch of drugs that probably, at least for the moment, don't work, probably because all the other stuff, you know, the basic BLS components of really good CPR and no pauses and good depth and lean and good airway management are taken care of. And again, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about airways, but I won't get into it in a big way. But again, until you've looked at your CPR tracings and done, you know, so-called annotations and look to see how, what does your CPR really look like? And just, you know, give you an example, like some studies that have been done have made it very clear that let's say a 10-second pause is acceptable during CPR, right? Maybe one or two 10-second pauses while things are shifting, you're doing rhythm checks, all that kind of stuff. So what the science shows is that if you pause once for 15 seconds during, and say, let's say you have a rule in your system, you got to do 30 minutes of resuscitation. So that's what, 30 times 60 is 1,800 seconds. And just once, you pause for 5 seconds more. So you're talking about way less than a percent of that entire resuscitation. You have automatically taken away 50% likelihood of that person's walking out of the hospital, one single pause. And I promise you, you start looking at those tracings and you look at the number and length of pauses that are in your system. And again, I don't think because people are sitting on scene drinking coffee and relaxing, it's just there's distractions. And I don't, and we talk about pit crew, but even with pit crew, there is lots of things that get in the way of maintaining that careful CPR. And certainly packaging and taking patients down to the unit is completely not the way to solve that problem.
Well, and Neil, isn't that the reason why? And I'm reflecting back to the system I worked in 2013, people from the EMS agency actually came out to do training with the field. The focus, of course, being high performance CPR and getting away from the time issue in that you can make your best effort by doing everything you can do at the scene for that patient. And then you make a decision on whether they're viable enough to even transport. In some cases, after 30 minutes, you may want to call them. But, you know, when you're talking about the pit crew concept, they also looked at you've got family, you've got dogs, you've got all of that, but you've also got providers from other agencies that need to be able to work together. And, you know, the BLS firefighters will do their piece, and then the ALS will come on. And everybody kind of needs to know, if not following a strict guideline of, you know, pit crew, at least have a general idea of who should be doing what and how to work together. Because if you don't, that all goes to the detriment of the patient. Is this a trend seeing across the country?
Yeah, so I totally agree with you. Like, I think that's spot on that, you know, so you can have multiple agencies interacting, all of whom have probably spent a fair amount of time doing pit crew. But if they haven't really trained together, that entire choreography or like some, you know, in fact, we just instituted this recently, having a incident commander for cardiac arrest. In fact, we've now, and I believe there's a few other systems doing this, have asked, you know, let's say the fire captain or lieutenant or who happens to be, is now an actual incident commander. And so the, you know, let's say the paramedic on scene is going to still be the higher medical authority, or at least or the EMT until a paramedic arrives, whatever it happens to be. But there is one person who's not just, you know, I think typically, let's say first responders, fire captains, whatever it happened to be, would sort of manage the scene and the families and all that sort of process stuff. But we talked with our fire departments, and I think they're really into it, which is that why don't we have an actual commander who makes sure the timing is right and everybody is moving together the way they're supposed to. And as you said, I still think that's a little bit inadequate that, you know, I'm sure special forces groups that, you know, go to Iraq and Afghanistan spend time training together. They don't just all show up somewhere in some village and expect it to all work. And, you know, we have the most complicated scenes with the most complicated patients with little information and very bad environmental conditions. And with training, you know, you talk about airways again, you know, like it's fascinating to me. You can, you know, if you look at the national standard curriculum, right, to become paramedic in this country, you need to have had 5 pre-hospital intubations. And, you know, often that's done on a mannequin or it's not even authentic patient, so to speak. And yet, you know, if you're an emergency medicine resident or a nurse anesthesiologist, CRNA, or an anesthesiologist, requirements are much higher. So you take your average, you know, there's a great paper that came out of Austria that looked at, and I apologize if I'm overfree associating here, it just sort of comes to mind, but they looked at anesthesiology residents in a 4-year program. And they said in a controlled environment of a nice, shiny, clean operating room with constant supervision, the average anesthesiology resident needed something like 57 tries with a tube to be able to hit them with a 90% success rate. But we, of course, say, gee, you know, you could have done 5, maybe had 3 on a mannequin, and then we're going to throw you out into an inner city walk-up, again, with the barking dog and the screaming family, on your knees, in a dark room, with a patient with blood coming out of their mouth, and by God, you're going to get that intubation. I think it's crazy. It just doesn't make sense. So all of this has to be attended to in some sort of coherent fashion and not just spend all of our time racing around for task times. I mean, again, bosses have to worry about task times, but I think, you know, if a patient's complaining of a stubbed toe, yeah, you probably don't need 40 minutes on the scene, but patients with a bad airway or a poor sat when you got there or agonal respirations, you don't just slap a mask on them and get them out to the truck and wait for everything to go south.
So, Joe, you know, this just reminds me of your cadaveric training and how useful that's been, because it gives an element of training that you can't get on a mannequin. Would you agree? Of course you would.
I would, and that's exactly why we do it, because we can add in, you know, all those affective issues that Neil referred to related to, you know, the scene and the placement of the patient and a whole series of challenges that are in reality just distractions from more important stuff. You know, in addition to that, I think Neil completely, again, hit the nail on the head. You know, a lot of the metrics that we look at in pre-hospital medicine are metrics that are quote unquote easy to measure, and, you know, 8 minutes for ALS. I mean, that's sort of grounded in some science, you know, resuscitation science from way back. And as Neil also mentioned, you know, shows up in RFPs and proposals from, companies who are vying for, ambulance service jobs and saying that, you know, we can make it in 8 minutes. You know, I think part of that's because those things are easy to measure and are objective and don't require an awful lot of work. You're either 759 or you're 801. It's, you know, anybody can do this. And I think that's really one of the important key points here, is that to do really good quality QI and really understand how to train people, you have to get out in the weeds a bit, and you have to appreciate what things are important and why they're important. And I think that doesn't necessarily apply to every single patient. You know, I think the sprained ankle, if you want to worry about a 10-minute scene time and what your response time was, because it's really a customer service issue. They're going to be upset if the ambulance takes 30 minutes to get there. And that's what you want your service to avoid, because that keeps the complaints at the mayor's office down. Well, that's fine, but that's not medicine. That's customer service. That's Walmart. You know, the medicine comes in the training issues and the management issues related to these, much more challenging patients, which in reality are a much smaller piece of the work that we all do every day.
Yeah. And again, you know, I totally agree, Joe. And I, you know, and since you started this, you know, and I understand the podcast, you know, has a kind of a disaster focus. But again, if you say, and again, you'd have to see how many airways you do in your system, but let's say you do a couple a day or something in a reasonable size system, two or three or five, whatever it is, and you multiply it by 365, and, you know, some big chunk of those, let's say, are supraglottics. And if you have the percentages that we initially saw, let's say 20% of those are in the wrong place, you're talking, just even in a single system, about losing more people a year for no good reason than we lost, you know, in, you know, September 11th in New York City a bunch of years ago, you know. And we're constantly focused on, you know, whether it's start triage or, you know, the latest and greatest, you know, tourniquets or whatever it happens. And again, I don't know if you had a chance, you know, Chris Hunter gave a great talk on the, you know, tragic thing that happened in Orlando. And, you know, the tourniquets matter? No. People who've got, I don't remember what the calibers were, but, you know, 9mm shots to their chest and great vessels, you know, you ain't going to fix that with a tourniquet. So I just think our emphasis has really got to shift, and whether that's in the cadaver lab or in sim sessions or you know, having QA and educating our leadership. I mean, it is our responsibility. The fact that city leadership reads an RFP like that, thinks, by God, key thing here is to get, you know, to the scene in 8 minutes. And I'll agree with you, Joe, that that number originally came out of some research, but it was, I would say, more a prediction, because all the work that's come out after that has shown exactly zero benefit to an eight-minute ambulance response, right? Yet, but here's the thing which is fascinating to me. Like, there is really good evidence and really good science that if you don't get to someone in cardiac arrest, let's just say a non-traumatic cardiac arrest, in about 4 to 5 minutes and get real CPR and a shock, you know, assuming you can give a shock, you know, your chances of survival are close to zero. And but we're worried in the RFPs and everything else about 8 minute ALS response time. I think we should hold ourselves, you want to hold to a process metric, and by God, somebody better be at the scene in 4 to 5 minutes in a cardiac arrest. And again, just saying that is not good enough. If you have to go through 2 to 3 public safety answering points, you don't know how long it takes your call takers to get a call and dispatch it, and how long it takes people to get out of the station, you know, then those 4 to 5 minutes are gobbled up. And I think is the reality why, you know, you look at CARES and everything else, our survival outcomes in this country are terrible. We haven't budged the needle in 20 years. We still haven't improved bystander CPR. You know, so we do all sorts of fancy, we'll buy the latest technology to do this and that, but we're really not getting to the crux problem. And I do think we've failed in some way at educating our leadership about what is absolutely critical here.
Wow. There's a whole number of topics we could jump in for further discussion. Jamie, you've been quiet back there. Any thoughts on your part?
I'm just really thinking that, you know, I think what Neil said is true. And I was in the leadership role for a couple of years in my system. And I honestly, you know, didn't know what I not had I known then what I know now, I think I would have approached things much differently. But why aren't we educating systems? And I think it falls to a couple of things. And I'd be interested to see what Joe and Neil think about this, because you can say someone is the medical director or the EMS director for their system, and that can mean a whole host of things. They could be a volunteer. They could be just an ER doc who gets assigned the job at a local hospital and they sign paperwork and that's about it. They can be very involved volunteers or low paid physicians in a local hospital who are involved in a local system and do a lot of things. They can be paid medical directors in a big city system where the leadership refuses to listen to the medical directors. We've talked about that on this show before. So It really comes down to medical direction and leadership in EMS, and I don't just mean the physicians in this situation, but also all leadership, can mean a lot of different things. And that's one of the problems we have, is that our EMS system is so fractured in the way we apply care. Joe, do you have any thoughts on that? Or Neil?
I'll let Joe go first. I'll be glad to jump in.
No, go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly it. And I think if you did nothing else, but, you know, if you looked at budgets, I mean, I know certainly my system has a budget in the tens of millions. I've been in systems in the hundreds of millions. And you just look at the budget figures that go, and I'm not saying the medical director, but talking about, you know, there's no medical director, physician who can do this stuff alone. I mean, you know, even in this system in the old days, there was a great medical director here, John Griswell. But, you know, his staff in the old days consisted of a half a paramedic time. I mean, so great. You know, it's like what a lot, like you said, part-time medical directors in this country do. You do what you can. But in a lot of places, that means signing your name on a training document or maybe pushing out a set of protocols once every bunch of years or something like that. But all that other stuff is missing. And again, I don't know. I think there are probably some leaders, operations kind of people on the other side who just, it's not their thing. They don't particularly care about it. But again, I really feel that all of us, you know, my colleagues who work in these very big systems have not gone out of their way to stand up, maybe at risk of losing their job, and just said, I mean, I've had tons of disagreements in my systems and knock down, drag out battles with, you know, the operations side. But if you don't have the battle, no one's going to get there. And even, you know, I'll give you just another example. And again, it's like in the realm of dirty laundry, so to speak. But, you know, I'll leave the system names out. But, you know, one of the issues I've always had is about field training officer programs. So in one particular system, you know, it was your typical, you know, some small, I don't know, 4 to 5 weeks and paramedics are out. And I brought up some issues about, well, these people, we don't know that they ever, someone showed them how to use a pacemaker or how to do a synchronized cardioversion or learned how to do CO2. And I was told in no uncertain terms, look, we're not training paramedics here. These are people who've got their numbers. They got license or certain national certification. We're here to teach them, you know, the city streets and the, you know, SOPs and how to use the radio and how to do notifications and all that sort of stuff. And I'll tell you, once you dig into the QA and you start showing your leadership how many unrecognized VFibs you have and how many pauses of, you know, a minute or more during a standard resuscitation, how many missed, you know, whatever it happens to be, then I think people start getting the message that it is our job to take care of that. Just because you came out of a program, and especially if you worked in, let's say, a very low volume system, or let's say you worked in a giant fire system where there's, you know, 1,000 or 1,500 paramedics splitting a relatively small number of critical patients and airways, how the hell are you supposed to get or maintain the skills and experience to do that job? So again, to just bring it home, I think we have a tremendous job ahead of us. And I don't think, especially if you've come up through the ranks as an operations person, whether as a fire chief or as an EMS boss, again, you know, you've had the, you know, the numbers crunchers pounding away at you about, you know, keeping costs down, you know, especially when there's budget deficits and all that, and keep things moving. We've got to make more with less. But you got to show them, you know, like this mission. I mean, then just call frickin' Uber, you know, if that's all you care about. And we're going to put tubes in the wrong places and we're not going to shock them and, you know, whatever it happens to be. And again, I think we do our people a great disservice. Again, there's certainly many of our people who do this stuff maybe perfectly all the time. But, you know, we do something which is called like a perfect CPR report card, which is just, did you hit the rate, the depth, the lean, the chest compression fraction, the time on the chest, and what we consider our limits of pauses? And, you know, I mean, it's not perfect, you know, or perfect meaning you just hit those goals in the vast, 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 vast majority of patients. And again, that doesn't mean it's all terrible. It just means it's really, really hard to do. And in the absence of focusing, and, you know, I'll just give you one more example just to, you know, like a lot of systems use mechanical CPR devices, right? Great idea. I mean, again, the science is not clear that they're beneficial. In fact, there's a recent paper came out that showed they may actually be problematic. But let's just say we agree that if you have a potentially viable patient and you put them in a speeding truck to the hospital, it'd be better not to have, you know, a firefighter, EMT, a paramedic in the back trying to do CPR and blah, 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 blah. So if you do nothing else but take a look at how long it takes, let's say someone's doing CPR on the scene, somebody shows up or starts to put on the mechanical device, whether it's a Lucas or whatever else it happens to be. They're great devices. They work really well. But again, Mike Levy in Anchorage looked at this. We looked at it here. You'd be shocked. I mean, absolutely. It's depressing to look at the pause of what it takes to put on a device. So you've got systems which are using on all their cases, and then they have a 2-minute pause to put on a Lucas. Well, again, you almost might as well have shot the patient with a gun because you've now cut their survival chances. You know, for $15,000, you cut their survival in half by spending 2 minutes putting on a device. So again, here, when we first looked, it wasn't 2 minutes. The average in the system was about 27 seconds. But again, remember, 15 seconds is enough of pausing to cut your survival in half. So we spent an hour, honestly, with our supervisors going over how to put on a mechanical assist device. And you know what our average time for a Lucas is now? It's 9 seconds. So again, you get all the advantages of the device, not the device's problem. It's about taking for granted that all you have to do is buy this thing off the shelf and it's plug and play. There's nothing in our world that is plug and play.
Amen.
Well, training takes maintenance. Don't you agree, Joe? I mean, you need to upgrade the level of training, but you can't, and going back to what you were saying, you know, yeah, they get out of school, they go through the National Registry or whatever, but it's not, they're not going to maintain it, especially those skills that are infrequent. You know, the provider and the system has to be responsible for making sure they're fresh on those things. And Joe, that's right down your alley. Would you run with that one?
Well,
and you know, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead, Neil.
No, I just to back up what you're just saying, that, you know, there's this also very, I hate to sound academic-y, but, you know, you talked about research before, but, you know, Henry Wang, who's done a lot of airway research, did this fantastic paper in 2005 where they looked at, they just took all the patient care reports for the entire state of Pennsylvania for the year 2003. And, you know, I think there was something like ballpark, like a million, you know, interactions or that they had records for. And of those, they just looked at all the ones where an advanced airway had been placed, right? And again, the number was maybe about 10,000 or 11,000. And then they divvied it up by provider and they said, well, let's just take a look out of all of those, how many airways, advanced airways, does the average provider get to manage? And it's startling. I mean, you know, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think it was like about a third, up to 40%, got exactly zero airways in the space of the year. Another third got something between zero and two airways. And then there was like, I think another third that got maybe on, you know, the mean or median of up to about, you know, four or five airways. But the problem is, like you're just saying, is it's the initial burn-in of this skill, but it's also about the maintenance. And how in the world do you want that person? I mean, I always think about, you know, let's say you've got some very unusual brain tumor or something that haven't been, or even just a brain tumor. I mean, do you want to go see the brain surgeon who operates, you know, and sees one or two of these a month, or do you want to go to a super tertiary care center where the guys are in the operating room, you know, three times a week for 12 hours doing 11 cases like this, the neurosurgeons? I mean, which EMT or paramedic do you want showing up at your house? And again, it's not their fault, but how are you going to maintain that skill, cognitive, affective, mechanical, whatever it happens to be, in the absence of doing it? It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I agree with that completely, Neil. You know, and for many of these very high-level skills, we do them so infrequently. We probably have the core concept down, but we quickly lose, you know, the subtleties that we talked about earlier, the little things that can make a difference and can go wrong. And just as you mentioned with mechanical CPR devices, you know, it's a great tool if you use it right. And but if you're going to take 2 minutes to put the thing on, then, you know, it's a complete waste of your money. Yet right. Nobody thinks about it in terms of that. This thing is supposed to do a better job, so we'll just get one of those and that'll fix all our problems. Exactly. Because it's a whole lot easier to go, you know, buy a pill that's going to take care of things than it is to get people to really understand with the level that they need to appreciate the nuances of the work that we do. We live in a world of nuances in EMS and disaster medicine all the time. And I think that's part of where the training really comes in, that you've got to make sure people have a sense of that and appreciation of that.
Absolutely. And the only thing I'll add, you know, we've been talking about it endlessly, but so I agree 1,000,000% that it is the training and it's got to be the right training. But I also think the training in the absence of QA, right, which is, and I mean real QA, not like pseudo QA of looking at checkboxes, but, you know, that you're, folks in the field have exactly the tools they need, all the speedometers, so to speak, to measure how they're doing, and they have feedback devices. And then in turn, on the back end, we all have to take responsibility for making sure that where there's gaps, that we're addressing them and fixing them on an almost daily basis. And there's always going to be gaps depending on the level of, you know, how well people were trained, how much experience they have, you know, how high a volume of a system have they been in previously, whatever it happens to be.
And Jamie, it's amazing how all these discussions come back to training, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And training goes, like Neil said, training goes hand in hand with a good QA system that is doing real really looking at the adverse events, looking at the skills level, all of those things. And you know, I'm wondering, Joe, you know, how do you guys at Paragon fit all that in to when you come into a system and you bring your training, your cadaveric training, your cadaveric training. Sorry, I'll say it right one of these days. but how do you bring all of that together to a system? Do you have to look at what they're doing and get a handle on that before you can really bring training there?
Well, that's certainly a piece of it. You know, part of what we try to do is work with the folks that are bringing us in to make certain that we understand what it is they're doing and what they're trying to accomplish and addressing those issues. And then that's just an integral part of what we do, whether it's a basic procedural lab or it's some sort of disaster-based training, is to make certain that those, again, subtle and not so obvious issues are talked about and are part of that training, so that folks at least have some awareness that this is a whole lot deeper understanding of this issue than I've ever had before. And that, I think, is really the key that we work toward.
If folks want to bring you guys in to do some training in their system, maybe they're interested in learning a little bit more about whether it's disaster training or maybe they need help getting a handle on their QA for preparedness and training. You know, where can they reach out to you guys?
Well, you can find Paragon Medical Group on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group. We're on Facebook, ParagonMedicalGroup.com. You can reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Thanks again for your continued support and helping us to put this show out there. We do appreciate it. Neil, this has been a fascinating show, and I've already got a title up for it on what I'm going to post for this Thursday, because I think looking at the real MCIs in our system is really what this show is about. And hopefully that'll get some people's eyes and they'll listen to the episode and internalize some of this. But is there a place where people can reach out to you? I don't know if you want to share something.
Yeah, I'd be glad like an email would be okay.
That would be fine.
Yeah, it's very simple. It's just N for Neil, Richmond, Virginia, at MedStar911.org. So that's N Richmond at MedStar911.org. And sure, you know, it's funny, we've been talking about it here, but not because we're so special, but there's certainly a number of people around the country who are thinking about this kind of stuff and doing it. But anything we could offer to show you a little bit, you know, that's not that expensive to do a lot of this. You just have to have some, you know, human power, man or woman power, so to speak, to get the work done. But this can become a focus, and it's not impossible to reach. We'd be glad to help show, explain that, or help someone think about how to build a system like that. And again, thank you so much for the opportunity to interact with you guys and great conversation.
Well, thank you for sharing your expertise and your passion, because I think that's as important as anything else, is that we become passionate about doing this the right way. So thank you.
Yeah.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, under a bunch of moving boxes at the moment, but I will be coming up for air sometime soon. And when I do, when I get my internet going again, you can find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, and also on our Facebook page. And maybe, Neil, that's something you can hook up with. It'd be hard to believe that this conversation doesn't engender some questions. So maybe some folks could pop over there, if you're there, and ask those questions and get an answer from you. So Jamie can explain to you how that all works. And that's okay. Pretty much it. Jamie, what about you?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic on most all social media programs out there, and I'm looking forward to interacting with you all. And, of course, you can find me on our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And it's pretty active. People check in and catch our episodes on a weekly basis and sometimes leave questions and comments on episodes. And you can always find that by going just to Facebook and searching for Disaster Podcast. Just ask to join the group. One of us will let you in and become part of the community there. We're really enjoying being able to interact with folks in that way as well. Sam, I think about this, and we talk about disaster medicine at the end of every episode, but I'm thinking this is everyday medicine.
It is, and there's a lot to consider. I guess it's just a matter of stretching the definition of disaster medicine, but as we know, we've always said disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine, but is it or isn't it? That's the question.